so we don't violate any rules. And with my co-chair's permission, I'd like to just make a few prefatory comments to the task force. I was hoping that this meeting would be run slightly more formally than in the past, because we're looking at attendance and possibly a vote. So I'd like to just take a moment and go through the list of membership to make sure that everybody is on the same page. I'm counting 14 voting members and 2 non-voting members. The 2 non-voting members are Dean Mitzel from Trinity, who actually has not been in attendance because of his schedule, so that's not an issue. And the other person was never appointed, so that's not an issue. So there's really 14 people, and the individuals I have are David Newman, Ann Ulick, Kathleen Queen, Tim Phelan, Representative Urban, myself, Representative Vargas, Representative Esposito, Anthony DeGeorge, Representative Carter, Brent Cleveland, Senator Witkos, Richard Maloney, and Dr. Ginsburg. And that's what I have for our composition. I've also asked the LCO just to verify my understanding that any vote we take, you need a majority of votes of those present and voting. So that's the rule. And I asked them to be prepared on any other legal question that might arise that we would need guidance from them. So with that, as I said at the last meeting, yes.
Just one question, Mr. Chairman. With respect to all the votes present, are we able to leave the votes open for any period of time today? That's been an established practice in the legislature. Just curious if we could do that until maybe 4 o'clock or something.
I did ask that question to the LCO this morning, actually, and my understanding is we can act just like a formal committee of the legislature to basically recess, hold the meeting open until a time certain, at which time the meeting becomes adjourned. So they would have to go to the clerk of general law and record their vote.
Mr. Chairman, does that require a motion, or is that just something that...
Normally, the chairs would just announce that it's being held. My understanding, chairs can always be overruled anyhow, but... So I would just suggest that we wait and see where we are at such time as we vote, and once we have 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So there's 3 people that are missing. And Angel, you're taking attendance of who's here, so we have that recorded. So I just want to make a few prefatory comments. As I said last time, it has been a real pleasure serving with all of you on this committee. I know that I learned a lot about something that I knew probably nothing about when we started, and it has been eye-opening. And, you know, if you're looking to see if the glass is half empty or half full, I like to think that we're more than half full, in the sense that we come from the same goal point of trying to make sure that we're protecting our children and that whatever we decide is safe. And secondly, also recognize that we do have a jewelry industry that contributes to the state of Connecticut and our economy and to family life. And we're trying to see if we can find a solution that perhaps supports both aspects of our industry that exists, but you know, of utmost importance in my mind is making sure that the children are protected. And I think that we have headed in that direction. Some of the details, obviously, there may be differences of opinion on, and we will certainly address those shortly. Finally, to get the ball moving a little bit, I had mentioned at our last meeting some general concepts and thoughts that I would be proposing to try and give us some recommendations to present. And in talking to my co-chair over the last week, it seemed like we had good consensus and agreement on all points except for the blanks that were left in paragraphs 2 and 3, which would be the numerical threshold parts per million that should be inserted, with a footnote that I have indicated at the last meeting and again today that I support the 300 parts per million, and Representative Urban wanted more discussion and opportunity for input before she determined what her final position would be. Lastly, just to remind those of you who are not legislators to put all of this in perspective, we have spent the summer going through, listening to experts, discussing the topic ourselves, and today we may vote on some recommendations. What does all that mean? What it means is that the recommendations go forward to the legislature and they are sent to the committees of cognizance, and there may be two, possibly three committees of cognizance. One would be general law, one would be children's committee, and possibly public health. And those committees would have their hearings. Maybe they would, we would get together and do some joint hearings, maybe not. We, it might engender new testimony, new submissions, but ultimately each committee would have to vote to raise or support legislation to go forward. The purpose of this task force is to give them a foundation upon which to debate this and go forward, but when you, at least my perspective in part, is that by making recommendations and seeing if we can come to a consensus or maybe even unanimity, it doesn't mean that this is written in law and can't be changed. It still has to go through a committee process, and there may be new information that comes forward. There may be new perspective on any issue that comes forward that could possibly change it. But undoubtedly, at least the way I look at it, this is a task force. We've been, charged with studying this issue, and hopefully the committees of cognizance will take seriously the time that we've spent and the recommendations. But just to clarify, because one person asked me, if we pass something today, even if I'm a little hesitant or whatever, does it mean that this just gets passed by the legislature? And the answer is no. It still has to go through the process. And so some of you might be shaking your heads and saying, wow, we spent all this time and, what we decide isn't final. And unfortunately, it's not, in the sense that the committees still have an opportunity to review it and modify it if they so wish. So, again, I just ask everybody to keep that in perspective. I guess just moving on to the last thing that I will say, and then I'm hoping that we can engage in discussion and questions. In my proposal that I think everybody has, it was sent out by email on Friday, so you could have the weekend to review it. I propose a two-test standard. One is the surface coating test of 75 parts per million, which would be discretionary by DCP, but I thought it was important because at least the manufacturers would have to know that they should be prepared to comply with that test should DCP elect to administer it, and I suspect that DCP will probably administer it on some sort of a basis. But paragraph two is the total content test, which we've studied and learned about. And again, from my perspective, I'm very comfortable with the 300 parts per million, especially in light of Dr. Ginsberg's complicated memo, which I can't honestly say I understood all the calculations, but I did understand the bottom line. And clearly the 300 parts per million, if I read his memo correctly, is safe and well below what he would consider to be unsafe. So given that, and given the fact that it coincidentally happens to equate to this industry standard that they're attempting to get adopted in a majority of states, it seems to me to make sense that it protects our children and it is consistent with what the industry has attempted to do. Now, I know that won't make everybody on the committee happy because some of you have suggested in other meetings that the 300 threshold be lower than that. But again, when I thought this through myself, I felt that when I looked at the numbers that Dr. Ginsberg provided and questions to other experts who essentially, according to my notes, said there was no difference really between 75 and 300, came to the conclusion that 300 was adequate. On the other side, for those who would like to see a more broad or a third test that would perhaps override the first two tests, which is the solubility digestive migration test, you can see from my commentary that we've made it clear that there would be no further tests because the leaching or extraction testing, I concluded, was too unpredictable and too many assumptions and variables. So I know that this proposal is something that maybe nobody is happy with, and I know in the legal field when we try cases or do mediations, the judge comes in and makes a ruling, and usually both sides are unhappy, which means that oftentimes it's a pretty good agreement. And I'm hoping that the committee will see that this is a good solution, even though not everything is in here that everybody wanted. I also have in paragraphs 4 and 5 powers to the Department of Consumer Protection, DCP, to issue cease and desist orders and to do their own testing if they go in and inspect on their own. And I have a proposed fine, which would be under the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, CUTPA, which is something in general law that we use all the time for referencing violations of consumer protection type legislation. So it's something that we're more familiar or comfortable with. But at the last meeting, somebody, I don't remember who it was, also mentioned the State Child Protection Act, so we checked that out, and that seemed to be applicable, at first reading to the situation. And I know that a couple of people have quivered a little bit when they saw that there could be imprisonment, and my own feeling is that you're probably talking about that punishment only when you're intentionally misleading or trying to defraud somebody. I don't think that if there's an error or an honest mistake that anybody is going to prosecute you for imprisonment, at least on the first time. But again, that could be an open question because it's not any of us around this table who will enforce this law. And then, the LCO has indicated there has to be in a statute an appeal process to meet due process requirements. So I provided for that. Is paragraph 6 on the website, I suggested that the health department, in connection with DCP, and it could be any other agency as well, would create the website, which would make parents aware of safety issues and precautions taken to avoid accidents. And I think that this would be a great resource to consumers and to parents in particular. And then paragraph 7, which I did not discuss at the last meeting but came to my attention in the interim, is a way to require jewelry manufacturers, and actually it probably should include distributors as well, to register so that we know who they are and where they are, so that if DCP wants to do an unannounced inspection, or there's a complaint, or something is found to be, let's say there was a malfunction in the process of creating the jewelry, and DCP, there was a recall or something of that nature, they could notify everybody who registered. And we had, you know, a registration fee that, at least in my case, I would defer to DCP. Normally, they will recommend a fee that is consistent with covering their costs or out-of-pocket expenses. And frankly, I have no idea what that might be, but it's not intended to be punitive by any measure. It's really intended just to cover usually administrative costs. So that, you know, is the rationale for what I propose, and at this point I would be happy to ask my co-chair to say anything she wanted to say or ask questions, and then we can go around the table and see where everybody is. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And I just want to reiterate what David said about working together on this task force and the amount of time and effort that's been put into it. And I really appreciate all the information that we've been able to gather on this subject of cadmium in children's jewelry. I think probably doesn't come to as a surprise to people that the 300 parts per million is a number that worries me as chair of the Children's Committee, with cadmium a known carcinogen, and with the European Union actually banning cadmium in jewelry. And I guess Canada is not looking at a lower number than 300 parts per million in their proposed legislation. I did have the opportunity to talk to Washington State again. They're at 40 parts per million, and they are defending that number as we speak. I think there is a move to try to get them to change that number, and they have told me unequivocally that they do not want to change from the 40 parts per million, basically because of the protection offered to children. So I would love to entertain a number closer to 100 parts per million. I'm not going to suggest that we ban cadmium, because I think that there is a certain amount of cadmium, background cadmium, that would be difficult. But I do have several issues, and I'll put these out there so that we can have responses to be sure that the information in reviewing my notes has been correct. And I think I want to start with, it's my understanding that there is a adequate substitute for cadmium, that you don't have to use cadmium when you're producing jewelry, and that that substitute just happens to produce a higher cost. So that would be one of the, you know, one of the issues. If there is a substitute, then why do we want to use a heavy metal that's carcinogenic in children's jewelry? It doesn't make any sense to me if you can substitute zinc for cadmium. And the other thing that was very interesting to me is that the jewelry, from my understanding, is not manufactured in Connecticut or even very much in the United States. That this jewelry is basically, these manufacturing facilities are in China. And I think that that's a pretty salient point, that we are looking at jewelry that's not actually manufactured in our country. We're looking at manufacturing facilities in another country, and I really would like clarification on that. And then there is another issue that I'm still concerned about, although Representative Barham and I have gone over the proposal, still concerned about the distressed jewelry and whether we couldn't ask for some kind of random testing of jewelry that had been marked up or distressed or stomped on or whatever by a child to see if that changed. And I do understand that the testing process there gets a little more involved. And then I have a specific question for Department of Consumer Protection, and that is the initial first section of this authorizes DCP to do this testing of 75 parts per million, and whether DCP feels they would be able to do that testing and whether they have adequate resources to do that testing. So I'll throw those out there to begin with and see what kind of feedback that we get. And
so with those two opening statements, I suppose, which I think in a way summarize the two perspectives in some semblance, maybe we can, go around the table and either ask questions, and obviously the questions you ask, we would look to some of the resource people who are here to help us with answers, or if you have comments or other suggestions or questions, you can ask those. We don't have to go in any particular order. I would just ask if, you could raise your hand and we'll recognize you and we'll just go one at a time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Madam Chairman. I appreciate the work that you went to put into this, and I think it's a great beginning. I think when in item number one, when you talk about testing, you're just starting the process because there are other questions of how do you test? Do you test the whole piece in its entirety? Do you break it apart in component parts? Do you have any exemptions, exclusions? We heard from a doctor that whatever was bound in glass was not bioavailable and therefore would not be a problem. If you remember, he gave the marble story that, if his grandson had swallowed the marble, what would he do? And he'd say nothing because it would not be bioavailable. So in that whole process, I would suggest that, we look at things like interlaboratory variability. When you use the XRF gun under the ASTM protocol, you have to go through a calibration process on a regular basis. I believe it's daily when it's in active use. So if that calibration becomes off, you could be as much as 15, 20, 25% off on your reading. So the ASTM standard does deal with that. It also deals with the exemptions. So in that aspect, it might make sense, in number one, to interject something saying authorized use of the 75 ppm standard as found in the testing protocol in the ASTM 2923 standard. That would certainly it would alleviate Connecticut's requirement to go through all of those concerns and determine how the testing is to be performed and what other calibration instructions would need to be followed. Under number two, again, I support 300 ppm. I think that's a good screening level. I am somewhat concerned that this is turning a children's jewelry safety bill into a chemical reductions act, that this really isn't based on the exposure hazard of children's jewelry. And so for that, I'm somewhat disappointed. However, there's been much discussion over this, and as we did in California, we agreed to the 300 ppm total content. So that would be a good place to start. As we go down to some of the other concerns, I'm extremely concerned about the registration fees that companies would have to file. This really ends up being nothing more than a tax on both small and big business. And dealing with a manufacturer versus an importer versus the brand versus who is going to have ultimate liability for this and who is going to pay the testing costs. Often the retail agreements between suppliers and the retailers are brand negotiated contracts. And so that would have to be more clearly defined. Let's see. I found, too, that it, you know, I was, again, surprised when I saw the imprisonment, thinking that if an Avon piece, picking just a random name, would find to be non-compliant, who would serve the jail term? Would that be the CEO or the compliance executive, or would that be the person, the quality control person who was in charge of that process? It would be very difficult to enforce, and I'm not sure that it would make much sense. To be intentionally misleading is, of course, another thing. Realize that all children's jewelry gets tested prior to being shipped to the United States, and it gets verified on a random basis at the United States border. Non-compliance product is sent back, is not allowed entry into the country, and so that is a way of taking care of that process. You bring up an interesting point about an appeal process, because, of course, I'm thinking about this, that if I'm a manufacturer and I've provided merchandise out in the marketplace and aware of 75 ppm total content in paint and it ended up reading an 84, then somebody then is going to send me a letter saying I'm in non-compliance and have some kind of monetary charge. So in that, where do I have the ability to answer to that claim, and can I defend myself, and what would be the terms of that defense? And I was thinking, too, that it might make sense in that venue that if somebody were charging me with having a violated product, I would be able to do a migration test to show that the product was not harmful. That might be a nice compromise that I would be able to provide to Connecticut without cost and have that serve the purpose. So I guess those are my opening comments. Are there any questions?
I would just, since it's the co-chair's general proposal, just try and answer a couple of quick questions that you had. In paragraph 2, the last line, it does indicate the test is applied separately to each component part. So that at least the intention was to have it applied to component parts. The issue of compliance with ASTM standards, such as calibration and glass, my only concern is that I'm not, off the top of my head, familiar with what else might be in that standard 23 or the number was, and so I'm a little hesitant to jump into adopting a standard that I don't know the full complexity of what that says. If it only addressed calibration and glass, I might feel more comfortable, but it could have 1,000 things in it, and so I'm hesitant, and if we were, as a committee, decided to add some further detail, I would rather that we just add it and let the LCO decide how to address that at such time as it's drafted, which again would not happen until the committees go through their process.
If I could interject, one clear description is that the ASTM standard affects plastic and metal components, because that's the only place where cadmium can be found. Take away paint surface coating, it doesn't exist in anything else. And so by having those exclusions, or I should say specific inclusions, you're saving testing costs and still providing safety of the product.
Again, what you, at least to me, what you say makes some sense. My only hesitation is one that I'm not familiar with the full scope of this ASTM standard 23. So I would be a little reluctant at this point, personally, to incorporate it. A couple of other questions in terms of registration fees. Again, I'm not in a position, and I did speak with somebody at DCP, until they analyze this and really understand what the costs would be. I don't think anyone's willing to make a recommendation what the registration fee should be. I think I can, you know, just try and reassure you that it's not intended to be a tax. It's not intended to be punitive. It's intended, like most other registration fees, to cover their administrative costs. And again, I guess the last thing I would say is with regard to the migration test, at least at this time, I know that that's been important to the trade and the industry, but it's something I personally am having a lot of difficulty embracing because of the testimony that I've heard. And I feel that, you know, the testimony from the industry has been that they have been trying to comply with these standards anyhow in the last couple of years, and that most of the jewelry, if not all, it's been represented, meets these standards. So my feeling is you have a standard and you meet it or you don't, and if you don't meet it, it's a violation. And I'm just uncomfortable putting in yet another test because of the unpredictability and the cost to the state of Connecticut and the manpower to conduct such tests. So I think this keeps it simple. It reflects what at least one other state, California, has adopted. And so I would not feel comfortable personally bringing in this third test. Anyone else like to offer an opinion or a question? Dr. Ginsberg?
Yeah. When we first started looking at the bill being in the direction of removing the 75 part per million, I believe 2010 law, and going back to the drawing board and seeing what the new science says and what we should be doing for 2014, 15, and beyond, we were surprised that there was so little scientific basis for the 75 number. I think that it was based upon the surface coating, and then it was turned into a total content standard in Connecticut as probably the simplest approach. And when we looked at it more over the last couple of months and tried to see what the calculational basis would be for deriving a more scientifically grounded number, you know, you have what I put in front of you, and it's not based upon a lot of data. But I think it is, when we do risk assessment, you know, we try not to underestimate. We want to be able to sleep at night. We don't want to underestimate risks. So I put forward to you what we feel pretty comfortable is probably a conservative or health protective version of events based upon what is really not a lot of data. So, you know, if somebody wanted to say, well, no cadmium is better than any cadmium, I couldn't disagree with that. It's not based upon cancer concerns, which I think Representative Urban's concern is this is a short-time, one-off type of event. Cancer is typically a small incremental dose over a long period of time that will add up to cancer. You know, this is something that is more of, of an acute kidney concern. I think we, based upon what I've seen, based upon what I feel the literature is showing us, a number of 300 would meet our concerns about acute kidney damage. I think the difference between 75, where we were before, and 300 is not all that distinct or great or marked. I think we're all in the right ballpark in that range. I think going from 300 to 3,000 or 1,000, you would clearly be in a range of concern. And I think that having a solubility test, which might allow something higher than 300 in based upon passing some extra test, would be problematical because we don't know that that extra testing is going to necessarily be simulating what a child might do to it. So Let me just see if I have. So the distress jewelry testing, I wouldn't want to make it more complicated by doing any more testing like distress jewelry testing. Whenever we do risk assessment again and we have to deal with a bright line, whether the number is 200, 300, 400, 100, it's always hard to come up with that bright line that pleases everybody. I think that there is some value to trying to be consistent with what else is out there, unless you really disagree with that. And I think what California and ASTM have, is as far as 300 goes, we're pretty comfortable that that is in a good comfort range. Glass bioavailability out of glass, I'd have to see the data. I mean, I haven't spent the time to look at that. If there are any data that says that, it just if it doesn't exist in glass, then people shouldn't have a problem with not having that in the bill as an exclusion, because it's not there, it's not there. You won't find it. If it is in glass and it doesn't come out, that has to be really solid data to support that. How the testing is done in ASTM, the bill has to be properly referenced so that it's clear whether we're using XRF or whether using for the total content, whether there's going to be atomic absorption or something else. I think those are my introductory points. If there's any questions about the memo I put out, I'm sorry. I tried to make it as simple as possible, going through the calculational steps and trying to put the uncertainties in there. But it is by necessity, it has a little bit of math in it. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Are there other comments or questions? Yes.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a comment about the testing. I know co-chair had a question about how we go about testing for cadmium. We haven't done it yet. We do a lot of lead testing. We do share an XRF gun with the Department of Public Health. And yes, it does have to be calibrated as you use it almost daily. Now, the secondary test that we will then engage in will be with the Department of Agriculture Experiment Center. And we would send the product there for testing, and we would then get the report back. So that's kind of the overview of what we foresee the testing to be.
So the initial test would be done by DCT, and then it goes to the Agricultural Experiment Station?
That's correct. And as I understand this as constructed, we would do the XRF test in the field with the gun, and then we would embargo, seize the product, take a look at it, and send it to the experiment station for further testing. Yes.
Confirmation.
Yeah, confirmation. Yeah, we'll get a report back from them.
So would you anticipate testing at the surface coating at 75 parts per million, or would you not? I mean, because that's at your discretion. I mean, in the proposal, it's at your discretion. So would you anticipate doing that, or what would be your thoughts?
Yes, that's right, Co-Chair. When we looked at this, we looked at it similarly to lead. That would be the intent of how we would deal with it. And if the legislature, if they propose to have it 75 parts per million, that's fine. I mean, we can certainly do it at that level or 300. It wouldn't really make a difference to us in our testing protocol.
Yeah. I talked to our lead XRF people and told them what the proposal was here, and they said it wouldn't be that difficult for you guys to test the surface and scratch away anything easily dislodgeable and test the total content. So it would be a quick 1-2 if there is a surface coating, which a lot of things don't have a surface coating. So I don't think that would be that burdensome for them to do that in the field. And it would be at your discretion.
I think that's correct, and we're currently doing that with lead. So it just simply is another piece of the protocol that we currently are engaged in. Yes.
Yes.
And just a question that comes up. I noted in reading the California law that I believe it was California, that the manufacturer is required to certify that the jewelry is safe, meets the current requirement, whatever that might be established to be. So rather than having just, if am I understanding this correctly, would that be required of our manufacturers and distributors, so that they would have to first certify that the stuff was safe, and then it would go on the shelves and be tested as it, you know, as they were, or are we putting the burden on the state to walk around testing jewelry on, you know, shelves and stores somewhere? You know, is it going to be something required of the manufacturer first and then followed up by our people?
Let me see if I can defer to Gary and Brent. First, Gary, to see if you're familiar with how they do this in California, and then Brent, if you have any comments on what's being done now. You mentioned two tests, one outside the United States and one inside the United States, if those are being reported to the state at this point. So maybe I'll go in reverse order. Gary,
okay. Basically, as part of the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2006, every single children's item out there has a label, and the label has a tracking number on it that is definable to get back to the manufacturer. So you could literally pick up any children's jewelry item in a retail store, see the tracking number, know who the manufacturer is, and you could contact that manufacturer and ask for the tests that he had to perform, because it is mandatory that everything that comes into this country be tested. And it's also often the requirement of the retailer that it be tested. So the retailer also has a hard copy of that testing sheet. Did that answer your question?
No.
Okay.
It did not, because the fact that there's a statement on it saying where it came from doesn't tell me what's in it. And I understand that it may have been tested, but perhaps it failed. And if we're going to rely on our state employees to have to go out and test this stuff, it would seem to me that it would be better to have it certified first that it meets the requirements, not just that it is. I mean, I can put a label on something saying it contains whatever it is it contains and say, well, I told you it was in there. The question is, will it meet the requirements, and will that be certified by the manufacturer and or distributor and or retail, I mean, however, whoever it is we determine should be responsible for that. It kind of goes to your comment earlier, Brent, about, you know, will we put somebody in, you know, who are we going to put in jail for this when they don't do that? I mean, California, they fine you $2,500 a day, and I wouldn't really care who the money came from as long as they got it somewhere. And that's sort of not the point. The point is you can say anything you want, but will it be certified by somebody that it meets the requirements, so that if we set those requirements, it's going to have some meaning to it. Laws are only for the law-abiding.
Good point. You're talking about trust and verify.
Yeah.
At any rate, all children's jewelry, of course, has this accompanying test. It was decided that it would be stored by the manufacturer. In fact, under federal law, he has to keep those tests for 5 years. So at any time after 5 years, after that product is imported into this country, you could contact the manufacturer and get that copy. But the way it stands now, you would have to ask him for it. The certificate of compliance that you're talking about in California also has to be available. There was a great deal of discussion as to who would hold that copy, and of course, retailers were going absolutely nuts, thinking that they would have to have 3,000 sheets of paper from 3,000 different manufacturers to cover the jewelry that they have in their stores. So it was decided then that the manufacturer would have that available either online. I think most are doing it online. But that's also part of the storage of the testing protocol that they go through. So realize, too, that everything that comes into this country has to abide by the ASTM 2923 standards. So there's the basis. If it doesn't, then, of course, there's the wrong that should be righted. So that's how that works.
Well, if I can defer then to our representatives from Health and DCP and ask them if this information is available anyhow because of the federal requirements, would it be helpful to the state of Connecticut to have a certification in addition to your own ability to test?
I think it's an interesting proposal that will probably need a bit more study to determine what the cost associated with that, make sure that it's effective, We do have quite a bit of experience with lead, and we do look at the tests, ASTM standard tests that are provided by the manufacturer to the retailer. We pull those documents when we're doing lead enforcement tests. So they do exist. And our experience with lead directly has been there was a precipitous drop in the lead that was contained in children's products in Connecticut as a result of the Consumer Product Safety Commission Act of 2006. We really find quite a drop-off. So I think we would have to defer that, Mr. Co-Chair, for a little bit more study.
It just seems like to have a certification process is another check that somebody has done the testing that they're supposed to be doing, and if we differ at all from a federal test, that we know that their certification shows that they've done what we want them to do for Connecticut's purposes. So for CPSC to be able, or I'm sorry, DCP, to be able to go to a place, a website, and see that what we're finding on the shelf does have a testing track record to it may give us more confidence that when they only test 10% of what's out there, that we know that they can, if the market's getting flooded with something, they can at least do a quick check and see that this other material looks like it's being tested by a lab that they've recognized or whatever. So I think having a certification a rule in our rule wouldn't hurt. I just don't know how duplicitous that might be with what the federal standard that Brent's talking about is. I haven't studied that.
And to follow up on that, we do a lot of that at DCP. We do a lot of labeling requirements. So, for example, bedding and upholstered furniture, we do have a test that the manufacturer goes about engaging in and conducting. And as part of the credential, we require that label or that test. So that would be part and parcel of any kind of a credentialing of the manufacturer.
So would it be proper to interpret, Richard, your comments as saying that if DCP were conducting these tests, they would have the right to ask for verification of the prior tests that were done or certification, but are you suggesting that it be at your request or mandatory that the certification be automatic?
I think you're talking about two completely different proposals. I believe that as an from an enforcement point of view, this proposal would certainly give us the authority to go in and seize any kind of documents or tests that were required to confirm and verify what we're seeing on the shelf. Secondary to that, the other piece of it could be a credential in a proactive type of a registration test and labeling requirement up front. So I think we're talking about two different, proposals. Does that help?
I think so. I think Kathleen raised an interesting point that I had not thought of before, so let's keep that in mind.
I think you raised a really interesting point, Kathleen. So, and I'm going to ask a question, and maybe Anne can help me with this. The recent testing of jewelry that has happened, and I know that New York State did it, and there were very high levels of cadmium. So it looks like maybe adding this certificate of compliance or doing something along those lines might really reinforce the seriousness of how we take this issue with our children. I don't know, Anne, if you have any information on some of those tests that just came out, the random testing.
I'm aware of them, and I don't know that I can quote the specifics off the top of my head, but you are right that there was testing done, and there were a lot of articles that had high levels of some of these chemicals that were quite striking and alarming to people. So I do think this idea that you've raised has some merit, and it strikes me that it's very similar to what some other consumer product companies do in terms of certifying that they're compliant with EcoSeal or GreenWorks, which manufacturers do to demonstrate that they are compliant with green chemistry principles. So that's another industry standard that's used that I think is similar and has been helpful to not only consumers who want to purchase and be sure that they're purchasing articles that meet those certain standards, but also I think it's also been helpful to manufacturers that want to market themselves as complying with those standards.
Are there other thoughts or questions? Yes.
Thanks, Chairman. Right now, as for lead, there are certificates of compliances that are filled out and sent out on all children's jewelry. Along with that, we do meet all the CFR regulatory regulations as well, which goes on the certificate of compliance. In our case, we do include cadmium as well, so it is a good idea to put that on the certificate of compliance to move along.
So if I understand your comments, you're saying that certificates of compliance are done, they exist, and if we were to add that to the proposal, it would just be a matter of sending an existing compliance certificate to the state.
Yeah, and all of the, you know, the certifications are done by an accredited lab. So when we're testing, it's not like an in-house test or an XRF test. It's done by a third-party laboratory that's separate from us. So that's how we're getting the certifications. And in certain instances, too, it comes from our customers because they require us to test with specific labs. And those labs will release the certificates of compliance to ensure that we're complying with the protocol set forth.
That's good to know. Representative Carter?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, with your comments, it's my understanding, too, that those certificates are available if something comes into the United States. So basically, they're getting tested by the manufacturer, then it's getting tested coming into the U.S., and then if they find something wrong, they can access those to see what the manufacturer's test looks like.
Yes. In our case, yes. We have all our manufacturers test their products on their own per component, and then we're adding test base on our end to retest all the componentry. And that also does come sometimes through our retailers, our customers who require a specific testing. So it's at least twice, and then those are kept in the database.
Other questions, comments?
I had one other question, I'm sorry. On the surface coating, I was wondering how we get to the 75 ppm and we're not at 300 and seeing as a substrate.
Let me defer that to our resident expert here.
Well, number one, 75, the surface coating is going to be more completely bioavailable than something that's of solid total content, so that whatever a child can dislodge and ingest is theoretically in finer particle scratched off the surface, more bioavailable, and the 75 content on the surface is directly from ASTM. So it's their surface test.
But as I understand ASTM, that's soluble levels, correct? It's not total. Is this total or soluble?
It's total. And ASTM in 1995 had it as the soluble test, and since then they have ASTM cited in 2010 the 1995 European Union test, which was a soluble test. The EU has now gone to, I believe, 14 parts per million on the surface coating as the soluble test. And so by us having 75 as the total, we're pretty close to or pretty much in line with soluble 14, 75 is total. But to represent that 75 is soluble, that's the old European standard.
Okay. But if, I need a little more clarity on my end, but I do understand when you're saying it's more, I guess, available because it's a surface coating. But even when you're doing solubles, aren't we diluting it out just to complete liquid form to do the tests for total? So wouldn't it be the same? When you're performing it like a test, it's getting melted out into using acids into and it liquefies the metal or the plastic, and then that gets tested out.
Well, the way that this would normally be done would be a screen on XRF confirmed by atomic absorption. We're not doing any solubility testing. Again, the old...
No, I'm not. I don't okay. mean solubility. I mean even though the total content.
Yeah.
When you even... I'm just wondering when we're doing surface coatings, and I know you're saying, I guess, it's easier to dissolve?
Yes. The well,
but we are dissolving totally down to liquid form, even on substrate forms, correct?
Well, the assumption is that what that small, at that point, is going to be almost like in powder form or finer particulate form. And when it gets down to the contents of the stomach, it will become completely, the assumption is, it will become completely digested in the stomach contents, unlike in, like a solid piece of jewelry, which even in 48 or 72 hours, the whole thing is going to dissolve. You'll still hopefully either pass it through or have to resect it out of the stomach because you're not going to get it out any other way. But no, this will be completely dissolved in the stomach contents. And so if you did an acid bath for 24, 48 hours, I would bet that all of it would come out within that time period. So it's appropriate to have it as a total content.
I agree. I was just questioning the difference between the 75 and the 300.
Right.
I'm thinking more towards 300 for both. In a 75-300, that's all.
Yeah, and it's a good question, but I think it makes sense. You'd have a lower standard for something that is going to be easier for the child to get at completely versus something that is only going to slowly leach off over time, the total content versus what can be completely ingested and dissolved in the acid content of the stomach. So it's a good question, but we looked at it pretty closely. And now Europe has gone to 14 or 15, something like that, for the surface coating. But that gets in the range, again, of a solubility test. And we're trying to keep this simple.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there less academic and more mundane questions? Representative Carter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make my general comments now. After listening for a while, I do credit the committee and the chairs for coming up with something that is consensus building. And, I will say that I am a little uncomfortable with the fact that we're not continuing solubility testing, because I think that is a more accurate picture of what, kind of thing could be in there that's a danger to our children. But I also understand it's very difficult for DCP to do that. So maybe doing it the way we're doing makes sense. But I also like the fact that we're not going out and just banning cadmium. I think that is short-sighted, considering majority of vitamins we take can be toxic to us. In fact, far more people have overdoses of vitamins every year than cadmium, far more. And it's really dangerous. Many of those aren't reported. So I think us looking at this responsibly makes sense. The one question I do have with Section 1, and this has come up about the standards, I think if the ASTM standards now are looking for total, as Dr. Ginsburg said, I think we should probably make sure we include that whatever we're doing in Section 1 is in accordance with ASTM standards. I think it's important to avoid confusion. Section 2, it kind of makes sense. I think the 300 made sense for a lot of reasons, not only your fine calculations, Dr. Ginsburg, but, at the time when that was created, it was done based on science. And so I think the 300 is reasonable. The other thing that comes out here as we move down farther are the fines, and that obviously I mentioned earlier to a couple people. I have huge problems with the way we're looking at this fine process and the amount of prison time that could happen with someone with, bureaucracies in government happen. And not that I'm not trying to hang out state agencies, but what ends up happening is people often push those rules with a very heavy hand. So I think we need to be very, very careful about what kind of fines we put out there and what kind of prison terms. And I think we should make sure that those fit the crime, so to speak. I think it's going to be very difficult to say that anything that a manufacturer is doing, once they've, you know, they've got their certificates on hand, they clear it through customs, and it gets here and something's out of whack, it's going to be really difficult to turn around and say it's a deceptive act, and we're going to be able to fine them anyway. Hopefully we do have some sort of a due process, but I think we really need to look at that fine. And I also don't believe that this should be a violation of the State Child Protection Act. I don't think this is a banned substance. It's a substance we're regulating. It's not a banned substance. So I think we should be careful about doing that. And finally, the credentialing. It's already been made very clear that due to the current federal laws, these pieces of jewelry are trackable. So it makes absolutely no sense in my mind that we should be creating another mechanism where we're going to have another fee, another fine, you know, something, another tax on these manufacturers to register as being jewelers or jewelry manufacturers. That makes no sense to me, considering, you know, they already pay $250 a year to the Secretary of State to have a business. There's plenty of other fees, and every piece of their product is trackable. It doesn't make any sense to me to turn around and say, well, we need to know where they are. So that's kind of the big picture feelings I have. I mean, I am going to support this going forward because I believe it's the best thing we can do as far as reaching consensus. But I think as we look at this and want to create law, those are going to be very big issues for me that I'm going to take a look at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any other comments or questions? Let's go with first time.
Just in general, just very briefly, I do appreciate all the work the committee did, and as a co-chairs, the work you put into it, and by appointing me to this committee, it's been very interesting. And I will say that I think overall this is a very reasonable proposal, and I think there are certainly important parts of this that we're going to have to continue to look at as it goes through in the legislative process, and I'm sure there'll be further debate. But I will say I was struck by a couple of things during this process. One, the testimony of the UConn chief of Division of Gastroenterology when he talked about the process that, you know, children go through when things, that objects get swallowed and stuck. And I contrast that, or I add to that what Dr. Ginsberg said earlier about the testimony of cadmium being, you know, cancer and its impact that it may have on individuals with the rate of cancer that may be caused by it, and the fact that you know, it's not sucked on and eaten and played with daily. It is oftentimes swallowed, and that swallowing process, the professor from UConn demonstrated to us is a reasonably quick process to go through the person's system. So again, I go back to the reasonableness of this proposal, including again what Dr. Ginsberg said earlier, going from 75 parts per million in section 2 to 300 parts is not a radical change. We're not going from 75 parts per million to 3,000 parts, which I thought was a very good point. I think it's a good, reasonable standard that allows us to stay on top of the issue, keeps us somewhat competitive with surrounding states or with other states. In fact, one of the largest states in the union, California, I think they're 300 parts per million. So it's not like we're, you know, completely out of whack in any of those areas. And for our industry, part of the reason why I'm on this task force to represent the retail industry, those are the things that we look for. We want to be able to say, how can we still provide a product that is in compliance, that is safe, but at the same time lets us meet whatever business needs that we need in order to remain competitive. And I think, you know, this proposal does that. I will share with Representative Carter's concern in Section 4, which has, and Section 5 would have some of the penalty provisions are fairly harsh, but I'm confident as we move through the legislative process, we'll be able to flush that out a little bit more and debate that some more. And finally, in Section 7, the definition of jewelry manufacturers is one that we're also somewhat concerned about. I want to make sure that definition is flushed out a little bit more. What is a jewelry manufacturer? Who does that include, and how does that impact business in the state? But overall, I think that this set of recommendations, as I mentioned, are very reasonable, and I do think that there are important changes that we have to keep an eye on, and that I am confident during the legislative process we'll be able to have further input before this gets ultimately addressed by the General Assembly. So, thank you.
Brian.
Regarding the enforcement, the biggest deterrent to noncompliance for a manufacturer is the fear of recall. The fear of recall is enormously embarrassing to the brand. It's expensive, pulling the goods back, issuing the credits to the retailers, making the offer to the public to buy it back at retail over a period of time. It's a huge, huge concern. And so if there were no enforcement provisions in here, that would still be the fear of recall. Representative Urban earlier was asking about substituting cadmium with zinc. That is a prevalent practice today. Cadmium is not used in casting as it once was in years ago. I think I've reported that several times. The high level of castings that they're finding have got to be old product, or it's out of the normal realm. As far as China is concerned, realize 95% of all costume jewelry is manufactured in China. That doesn't necessarily mean that these are all arm's length transactions of just bringing in blind Chinese product. In many cases, in fact, FJATA has members that have one in particular has four factories in China that do nothing but make merchandise for that brand. And when they issue a purchase order to that manufacturer, it's a 7-page document stating what stones to use, what the content of the stones are, the supplier, the weight of the metal to use, the kind of the thickness of the gold plating or the lack of. But all the bill of materials and the manufacturing specs would be involved in that process. So this isn't necessarily just receiving blind merchandise from Chinese factories. And also the last question she had was about being distressed. Again, during the ASTM process for the 29-23, an enormous amount of work was put into how long would it have to be in this acidic solution, heated, agitated, in order to deface the outer coating. And, you know, because, again, the old standards, even the EN standard, is a 2-hour test. So in going through this, they went through all these elevated levels. They found that the 24-hour test was sufficient enough to abrade the outer coating of the piece. And that would then, you know, reflect the inner component and could be effectively tested. So that's how it became a 24-hour test. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other comments or questions?
Just some comments. I, too, want to thank both co-chairs and all the members of this task force. I've learned a lot. I really appreciate everybody's attention and hard work on this issue. I certainly appreciate Dr. Ginsburg's expertise. Worked with him for a number of years on a number of issues, and I really respect his knowledge. But I still struggle a little bit with the standard. I think it's a good compromise, but I do really worry about the fact that we've learned that cadmium is bioaccumulative, that it has a very long half-life. So I'm not totally comfortable that we're only talking about a one-time acute exposure. Knowing kids, they don't just chew on things once. They suck on them. They chew on them. And we as parents or, you know, people that are with children might not always see them do that. But I think we know that children have a lot of mouthing behavior, so their tendency is to potentially have this exposure. So I do worry about that. I think cadmium in children's jewelry is a known source of exposure. It's certainly not the greatest source of exposure. We know that it is in our environment. But if we can reduce any source of exposure to a carcinogen, I constantly just ask myself, why wouldn't we, if there's an alternative? And this is just where my bent comes from as a nurse. I feel as though we still similar to what Representative Urban said, I struggle with the distressed jewelry piece, that, again, that children aren't just mouthing things once and then we take it away from them. I worry that that could be a cumulative exposure over time. And having seen kids gone through endoscopies, it's not an easy procedure. And it's certainly not one that I would want any child to have to go through unnecessarily. So I'm just wondering, and then upon learning that the EU has moved away from the use of cadmium in children's jewelry because of these concerns, I wonder why we wouldn't want to harmonize on a more global scale. If this is not an industry that is hugely present in Connecticut or hugely present even in the U.S., why wouldn't we want to harmonize in a global marketplace? That, to me, would not only reduce exposure or potential exposure, but it would also potentially allow American companies to market their goods on a broader scale. So unless I'm not understanding something, those are the questions that have been running through my mind, and I think Brent has done an extraordinary job. It sounds like you've worked on this for years, and I really commend you for that. But I know that for example, in health research, we've learned a lot even in the last 5 years, even in the last 2 years, of how chemical exposure during critical windows of development, even in infinitesimally small amounts that we used to never think were worrisome. Now it's unequivocally known that these small doses do accumulate and cause harm later in life. So for me, any chance that we can protect children, which as I've heard all of us want to do, and not harm business, then I don't understand why we wouldn't move in that direction. So maybe there's, you know, and I appreciate your thoughts about compromise, and I get that, I really do. I'm wondering if there might be a way that we can put some sort of provision, or maybe this comes up during the legislative process, I don't know, but is there a way that we can look at as other, you know, if indeed the European Union continues to ban cadmium in children's jewelry, for example, can we move in that direction within a date certain so that we are aligning ourselves with a broader marketplace? Just as a thought. So I think those are my comments.
Are there any comments or responses from Representative Vargas? Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one comment. Maybe you guys can correct me, but I've heard that the European Union and the United States and the industries are all getting together to come up with something right now, that they are looking at that. And I hope with some time and science, the European Union will come our way and see that 300 parts per million is where we should be. No, I understand, but it's like they are trying to do this. And I think for me as a legislator, I find it very difficult to say that I'm going to rely on the European Union to set our policy. You know, frankly, I'm not going to look at another entity and say, well, we're just going to do whatever they do and we're going to follow along. Because that doesn't, you know, that's a whole other political world. That's a whole other situation happening. We're not there to see the reasons they're doing it. I think we need to look at it and handle what's in our own house. And I appreciate your concern. I mean, I share it. And I do think, based on the science, that the 300 parts per million is protective. That's the reason we are coming to a lower number versus having something that's 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000. You know, we are setting that line in the sand where we're saying this is something protective. We could easily go out and say it's a banned chemical and we're not going to have it in anything. I don't think that is the way to go with cadmium. But I understand your concern, and I just kind of wanted to throw out that I do know that they're working together on that from everything I've read and everything I've heard even through this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have a question, I think, for anybody who can answer. We banned cadmium in packaging material in, I believe, 1992 because of the possibility of it getting in landfills and then into the water table. So if we banned cadmium in packaging material, why wouldn't we be thinking that it might be a good idea? We didn't say 300 parts per million or 75 parts per million. We basically said, no, we're afraid that this is going to end up in the water table. And that's been one of my concerns, is we did that. So if we're going to really be protective of our children, we, from my perspective, would want to go as low as we can go without compromising the ability to make the jewelry. And yet, as I understand it, we now can substitute zinc for cadmium. And I think Brent also said that the jewelry industry was trying to get out of cadmium altogether. I believe
intentionally.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, Brent. But you know, that's been one of my concerns, is that, you know, that aspect of it.
And again, we are very concerned too about the bioaccumulation of cadmium, and that's why we have such a small number, like 300 parts per million for an acute one-time exposure. That's a very small number. In fact, we found that when you did a migration test on the 300 parts per million total content, 100% of the time you had a non-detect migration level from that. So that's, in our book, as fine as you need to be. And again, the CPSC, when we were developing our standard, insisted that we use their cadmium protocol. This is the same cadmium protocol that is currently federal law in toys, the F963. We use the same testing protocol as that federal law. So even if Connecticut were to decide to do something different than the standard, they would still have the standard in play in toys. So again, as far as our concern is, it's been scientifically tested. It is health protective. It gives manufacturers versatility. It's a very small exposure number. It is health protective, and we think it's a good standard.
I'm sorry, I keep ignoring you, and you've
heard
before.
Okay. No, I probably need to be ignored. It's fine. All of the arguments that I've been hearing about the 300 number being reasonable and stuff are the same arguments I keep reading in the stuff that California did and other states have done and what Canada has done. And they keep coming up with all different numbers. And lower seems to be better. I don't know, in the Canadian stuff, all of the, like the migration testing, they're talking about 144 hours versus 2 hours, and they came up with their understanding that lower should be somehow better, because we don't have the science, apparently, to definitively say that this is the number that's going to affect X number of kids. And so I think the temptation seems to me to be to err on the side of going lower rather than trying to set sort of a median or some, and I'm not quite sure where the 300 becomes the magic number. You said Canada's number, I think, is 130, is what they come up with.
If I could clarify what Canada did, they assumed that it was 100% of the cadmium that's in that 7 grams, you know, small amount, is going to come out in the stomach contents. So making that very conservative assumption, they get down to 130. We looked at it and said about 10%. And I still think that's pretty conservative to say that in 24 hours, 10% of this, you know, thing that a child is swallowing, that it's going to then become dissolved and be available for absorption. So they assumed it was all available, which is the simplest, you know, approach, and you could do that approach, but I don't think you need to. I think now with Dr. Weidenheimer's data, and back in 2010 we didn't have his data, Canada's analysis was 2011. Weidenheimer's study was 2011, so they may not have had a full chance to look at that. But I picked the worst case out of Weidenheimer's data, and most of his data was 10 to 100 times less extraction than what he showed. I think you could easily argue for 1%, and I'm using 7.6% comes off in 24 hours. Regarding the bioaccumulation, we're really looking at the licking of an article at a different pH. It's a completely different scenario. If you're worried about repetitive swallowing of the item, you might get a buildup over time to that same kidney. But we're hoping that, you know, it's a sort of like a one-off kind of experience. Then if you're assuming that it's two times, three times, at what point do you say that the scenario goes completely different than this one-time acute digestion event in the stomach? You know, with lead, the poisonings we've seen are ingestion. It's not so much licking a piece of jewelry. So I don't think that we're as concerned about the day-in, day-out, chronic, surface-marred exposure, because the pH of the saliva, just you're not going to extract much from a piece of jewelry from a kid licking it, even if the surface is scratched. It's got to get down to pH 2 in the stomach.
Any other thoughts? I'd like to take. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Vargas.
I'd just like to join in on thanking all the members of the task force, especially our co-chairs, for all the work that went into this night. I'd just like to say that I still have some lingering concerns. One of them is many of the examples are based on one article. There could be in the child's possession several articles of jewelry. Exposure over time. It's at the last task force meeting, I had wondered if we perhaps could come up with a middle number between the 100 and 300, and perhaps settle on 200. I understand that a task force has to reach its finality and come up with a recommendation that is representative of all the thinking of the members on the task force, and all for compromise. And I know that the process will continue. After our recommendations leave this task force, it'll continue at the Health Committee, and they'll have their own public hearings, and people will continue to tinker with the legislation up to the point where it's hopefully enacted. The other thing that I was concerned about was simply I heard what Brent said about, you know, some of our companies, or I think it was the industry representative, said that some of our companies actually are the ones that are setting what the standards are in China. But also we have to keep in mind that China is notorious for knockoff products that are very similar to the products that our companies manufacture. And you wonder what standards they use in their knockoff products that somehow filter themselves into our market, too. But with all those concerns still lingering in the background, I think that overall the task force has done a good job, and I support, you know, the co-chairs. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to pose a quick question to Dr. Ginsberg. There was a colloquy that took place about solubility, and in the draft proposal, does any language have to be added to the 75 parts per million for surface coating, or is it okay the way it's written with and when it's finally drafted, if there's some technical stuff that has to be put in, it can be put in? I'm just wondering, are we missing something if we go forward shortly, because we sort of discussed this in full, whether or not we need to add anything to this, because I know that a couple of you were going back and forth, but I didn't pick up whether or not it was sufficient the way it is.
I'm just rereading it now, and it doesn't say as a total content, so it does leave it vague. And if you say that the 75 ppm test has to be according to ASTM, that could be interpreted as a solubility test, which was not our intent.
So I think to nail that down, it probably, to your point, it would be better to say 75 ppm standard as a total content standard for the surface coating. I think that would clarify it. And one other point I was going to get to regarding the credentialing or the certification, it could be valuable to require, and I don't know how the California bill works, but if it could be an easy check for DCP to just see if the manufacturers that are importing have done the testing, and if anything is, you know, to have one level of test of checking and fines, if they don't have readily available their test result for that lot of jewelry, then they don't even have to go to the store. They know that that's in violation. And then for those, so they might be able to do more than, you know, what their spot check is, just to see if things have the paper check and certify that the testing's been done. And then beyond that, you know, they can go with their gun and see, well, it says it's, you know, less than 300, but is it really? And then that could be a second level of checking and fines. So I think that the certification can make some sense.
So what I would like to boldly propose, with the understanding that this will go through the committee process and there may be new information, as Anne suggested, whether it's from the EU, Canada, or as Representative Carter suggested, the United States and the EU working together, there may be new information by the time the legislative process ends and we actually see a bill and vote on it. And it certainly doesn't preclude a future legislature from revisiting this if new information becomes available that suggests any standards we adopt might need to be revisited. To move this out of committee, what I would like to suggest are a couple of technical amendments. One would be in paragraph 1, in the second line, after 75 parts per million, to add the words total content, so 75 parts per million total content standard for surface coating. And while I don't have the exact language to add this provision, and it could be a separate paragraph, that DCP will create a certification compliance form to be submitted to verify, again, compliance. But the idea would be this certification compliance form. And for those of you who came in after the discussion, apparently the certification compliance is already being done, but the certification is being held by the manufacturer per federal law. So now DCP would create the form that the manufacturer, the lab, would send into the state, so we would have that additional information. And while I heard comments on the fine issues, I'd like to keep it as it is and say let the committee process flesh that out. Maybe they'll come up with something better, or there'll be new information. In addition, I've talked to my co-chair because I understand there are strong feelings about, you know, the total content test, whether it should be 300 parts per million or another. So what I've suggested, to give everybody an opportunity to vote for the overall bill and then express whatever they wish on the number, that we divide the vote and that the first vote be on the proposal as I've submitted with those two amendments, and then the second vote would be on filling in the blanks in paragraph 2 and 3 with a number, which again I'm recommending 300, but others may have other ideas and we can take those up. But it seems, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, everyone has a little concern about this or that, and understanding it will be fleshed out as it goes through multiple committees and public hearings, that I think I'm hearing everybody feels this is a good enough proposal to get out of the task force and move forward. So I think my co-chair is in agreement, Representative Fart.
I'd like to move approval of the overall proposal.
And that would be as amended.
Okay. As amended.
So that's moved by Representative Vargas and seconded by Representative Esposito. Okay.
That was being held for a separate vote. Right, I was taking a cue from through the chair.
But it doesn't through the chair. It does include the.
Through the chair, I was taking a cue from our chairman's recommendation that we divide the vote, looking first at the overall proposal and then voting separately on the total content.
And it does include the two amendments.
Yes, it includes the two amendments.
So in voting for all that, we're voting for the registration, we're voting for all the provisions as they sit.
Yes, the only thing we're not voting for, we're voting for this document as written with those two amendments, and we are not voting on what the threshold number should be in paragraph 2 or 3 for the total content test.
Mr.
We'll
Chairman, point of order.
Second vote. Yes.
I believe what has to happen is the good representative made a motion and it was seconded to take the whole proposal. I think what we have to have is him withdraw his motion, and then we have a motion whether or not to divide, is the way I understand it, or can you just do that?
I'll ask the LCO if the chair has.
Yep. What I heard was Chairman Barham made a motion to adopt the proposal before you, that's in writing, minus paragraphs 2 and 3, but with the two changes, adding as a total content standard in paragraph 1 and then also adding the certification paragraph. That would be the motion.
Well, not minus paragraph 2 and 3, it minus the number for parts per million.
Well, same result, but okay, minus the parts per million. So the motion would be the proposal before you with the additional language in paragraph 1, line 2, no parts per million specification in paragraph 2 or 3, and then adding a paragraph regarding the certification compliance form. Is that correct?
Right. So the motion is to adopt the document without filling in the blanks in paragraph 2 and 3 with those two technical amendments, and then the intent would be to accept another motion after this on the total content number. Okay, what I'd like to do is call for a roll call vote on this, and I'll ask our clerk if he could call everybody's name, and you would just say yes or no, indicating your support or lack of it.
Representative Urban. Representative Barham.
Yes.
Representative Urban.
Yes.
Representative Barham.
Yes.
Representative Carter. Brent Cleveland. Anthony DeGeorge. Representative Esposito. Dr. Ginsburg.
Yes.
Ann Hulick. Richard Maloney. David Newman. Tim Phelan.
Yes.
Kathleen Queen.
Yes.
Representative Vargas.
Yes.
Senator Witkos.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Obviously, that passes. What I'd like to do is call on Representative Esposito to make a motion with regard to the total content threshold number, and if there's another suggestion, we can do it by amendment and vote on the amendment, and then on the final number, whether it's amended or not. Right. So,
I'd like to make a motion that we adopt the 300 part per million standard for the first paragraph, it's in 2 and 3, right? In sections 2 and 3.
Correct. Is there a second? Second by Tim Phelan. Okay. Are there any other motions? Representative Vargas?
Yes, I'd like to offer an amendment that we reduce it to 100 parts per million.
Moved by Representative Vargas and seconded by Representative Urban to move it to, 100 parts per million. Okay. So what the chair will do is first we'll take up the amendment, and if you vote yes for the amendment of 100 parts per million, then that would pass and it would amend the main motion of 300. And if it if you're against that, you would vote no. And if it fails, then we will take a second vote on the 300 parts per million. So I would ask if there could be a roll call vote. Again, we're voting on the amendment of 100 parts per million. And if you support it, you say yes. If you are opposed, you say no.
Representative Urban. Representative Barham. Representative Carter. Brent Cleveland. Anthony DeGeorge, Representative Esposito, Dr. Ginsburg.
Yes.
Ann Hewlett, Richard Maloney, David Newman, Tim Phelan, Kathleen Queen.
Yes.
Representative Vargas. Yes. Senator Witkos.
I'll ask the clerk for a tally on that. I didn't keep track.
Five yea, seven nay, one abstain or recuse.
Okay, so the amendment fails, which certainly the vote was close enough to reflect some of the concerns of the committee. We go on now to vote on the motion, the main motion, which was the 300 parts per million. So we'll do the same thing, a roll call. And if you support the 300 parts per million, you say yes. If you oppose it, you say no. And if the clerk would do the roll call.
Representative Urban. Representative Barham. Representative Carter. Brent Cleveland. Anthony DeGeorge. Representative Esposito. Dr. Ginsburg.
Yes.
Ann Hewlett. Richard Maloney. David Newman. Tim Phelan. Kathleen Queen.
No.
Representative Vargas.
No.
Senator Witkos.
No.
Out of 13 members voting, those who voted yea, 8, those who voted nay, 4, those who abstain, 1, or recused.
Thank you very much. Again, I think that motion passes. And I think that concludes our business. Again, on behalf of Diane and myself, our clerk will draft the recommendations and submit them to, I believe it goes to the...
Under the Public Act, it's required not later than January 15, 2015, the task force shall submit the report to the Children's Committee, General Law Committee, and Public Health Committees.
And then it'll go through the process. The three committee chairs may get together and decide to hold a joint public hearing, or they may do their individual ones. And again, as it goes through the process, there'll be more testimony, information, and committees can make changes. Not to usurp Diana, but if I want to thank all of you for a tremendous effort, a real dedication of time. And this has been a great venture, and I have to say, you know, I think we all walk away respecting one another and each other's points of view. It wasn't an easy decision to make, particularly with regard to what the number should be, but I know that we can all feel that we had all the information available at the time. And hopefully, you know, the final conclusion will be one that we can all embrace. So I don't know if Representative Bourbon.
No, I'd just like to echo your words, and we're looking forward to carrying this on into session and public hearings and continuing to flesh out the information. So thank you, everyone.
Since we have everyone here, we don't have to keep votes open. And I would just ask, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved. Is there a second? Second. All in favor? It's unanimous. Thank you all very much.